Ladies and gentlemen, may I have your attention? Welcome to the Miller Center of Public Affairs. My name is Jerry Beliles, and I'm the director of the Miller Center. In fact, today, April 1st, marks my first anniversary as the leader of this one wonderful institution, and that is not an April Fool's Day joke. In fact, last year, my first official act, an event, involved this very group, SIAG, as it examined the London Transit bombings, as we all know and remember so well. But this conference was enormously productive and a splendid introduction for me to this group and to the Center. Coincident with this conference is the release of this impressive monograph of last year's proceedings, and I predict that it will prove an invaluable guide to the press, the public, and the politicians for years to come. Today, we convene for SIAG's 10th annual conference, this year's topic being on the issue of domestic radicalization. Renowned speakers and participants from the U.S., the United Kingdom, Sweden, and Australia will be featured. And while many of our special guests will be introduced throughout the conference, I want to single out two individuals for recognition at this function. They are SIAG's accomplished chairman, who is retiring this year, and a devoted friend of the Miller Center, former Ambassador Nathaniel Howell. And the second introduction is of an individual who is a very good friend of mine and distinguished statesman, former Secretary of State Lawrence Eagleburger, who, if he's not here now, will be heard from tonight at dinner at the Rotunda. Is Secretary Eagleburger present? If not, as I said, you will hear him at dinner tonight, and you will not mistake his voice when you hear it. The mission statement of the Miller Center says this: the University of Virginia's Miller Center of Public Affairs, following Jefferson's vision of the university's public service mission, is a leading public policy institution that serves as a national meeting place where engaged citizens, scholars, students, media representatives, and government officials gather in a spirit of nonpartisan consensus to research, reflect, and report on issues of national importance to the governance of the United States, with special attention to the central role and history of the presidency. The Center pursues its mission through academic and research programs, public conferences, and policy reports, one of which you will hear from within the year, as we have just announced the National War Powers Commission, co-chaired by former Secretaries of State James Baker and Warren Christopher, and soon to be launched, our national series of discussions and debates on national television. So SIAG fits squarely within the mission of the Miller Center's work, and we're delighted to welcome one and all. Since the first conference in 1998, SIAG's annual meeting in Charlottesville has assembled a complementary group of academic, media, government, military, law enforcement, and behavioral science professionals for the vital purpose of developing a process by which the federal government might better access outside resources in the private sector during times of national crisis, and to understand the impact of critical incidents on our people, our communities, and our social structure. SIAG has used case studies as springboards for discussion, and at all times sought to merge theory with practice. Because of the issues this group discusses year after year, SIAG has played a key role in understanding and responding to the challenges of homeland security and terrorism. The one person who has played the invaluable role in shaping, guiding, and leading SIAG is its longtime executive director, Dr. Greg Sattoff, who is also on the faculty of the medical school here at the University of Virginia. During my first year at the Miller Center, I've gotten to observe, work with, and admire this leading light in our community of scholars. Please welcome Dr. Greg Sawtelle.
Thank you, Governor. Well, once again, it's a pleasure to begin our Critical Incident Analysis Group conference with you, George Gillum, and your staff here at the Miller Center. And on your one-year anniversary as director, I speak for many when I say that the University of Virginia community is grateful to have you now at the helm of the Miller Center. Well, 1 year ago, Margaret Warner's public panel with 17 leaders was a tour de force, and we're fortunate to have her return this year to lead this public panel entitled Homegrown Terrorism and the Global War on Terror. In addition to Governor Beliles, we're honored to have another governor with us as well. Chuck Robb graduated first in his class at Quantico and had responsibilities at the White House prior to a tour of duty in Vietnam, where he led a rifle company in combat and was awarded the Bronze Star. Senator Robb attended law school at the University of Virginia and served as both lieutenant governor and governor of Virginia. He served two terms in the Senate and was unique in that he simultaneously served on all three national security committees in the Senate. During this decade, he's remained committed to public service. He's held positions on the Board of Visitors of the U.S. Naval Academy, served as adjunct professor at George Mason University School of Law, served as the co-chair of the Iraq Intelligence Commission, served as a member of the Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, and also was one of the 10 members of the Iraq Study Group, of which Ed Meese is also a member and here with us today. A few months ago, Senator Robb told me about this photograph on my left. It's a photograph of his father-in-law listening to a tape that Senator Robb had sent to his wife, Linda, recounting his combat experience. I think that this photograph provides a springboard for Senator Robb to set the stage for Margaret's panel discussion on the current global war on terrorism and its relationship to radicalization, because this photo was taken in 1968, a turbulent year of radical events. It's particularly significant that this photograph was taken in July of 1968, because in that same month, a 31-year-old named Saddam Hussein rolled into Baghdad as part of the bloodless coup that secured his party's Ba'athist control of Iraq. Abraham Lincoln said, "History is not history unless it is the truth." This public session is not complete, then, unless we are able to hear the perspective of someone who has served the public in so many critical ways. It's a privilege to introduce Senator Robb.
Thank you, Greg. I'm delighted to have a chance to return to the Miller Center, and I have enjoyed getting to know you and your SIAG group, and this is a unique opportunity. I'm particularly delighted to be with two friends. Jerry Beliles and I have served together in a concert for a number of years. And I don't know whether Nat is going to say anything specific about our first encounter, but I visited him. I think I was one of his first guests when he was in residence in Kuwait. His tenure in the official residence became a little more problematic, as many of you know, thereafter. I'm not quite sure, and I'm delighted to be with Margaret in this distinguished panel, and George is the one who's twisted my arm two or three times to come down here and talk for an hour or hour and a half, and I'm not supposed to do that today. Ed and I had a chance to work together on the Iraq Study Group, and that was quite a privilege. I'm assuming that I was taken from the expert panel, of which I do not claim to be a member, and put up here to give you a little time to get settled in your seats, sort of the warm-up act for the big band to come momentarily, and to try to relate a little bit between experiences in Vietnam and experiences in Iraq, or the situation in Vietnam, the situation in Iraq. Anything I would have to say would be a gross oversimplification, but some of the things are important. A couple of things to think about. In Vietnam, the U.S. was trying to prop up a government that didn't have the support of the majority of the population, but we were at least invited to come in there. In Iraq, the U.S. was trying to remove a government that didn't have the support, the real support of the majority of the population, and we had to force our way in. This has some important consequences when we talk about any kind of an exit strategy, and we have different obligations. Vietnam, of course, had a long history of being a sovereign state trying to evict colonial occupiers, the French first, and the Japanese, and the French again, and then the Battle of Dien Bien Phu in 1954, and Ho Chi Minh and General Gap pretty much settled the issue until we participated in the overthrow of Diem in 1963. Things changed. We had U.S. advisors, and that's how it all started out. In Iraq, it was largely a creation. Instead of having a long history of being a unified state, it was a creation pretty much of the British after World War II and ended up being held together by a dictator ultimately after he took power, Saddam Hussein. In his case, in Vietnam, you had a mostly Catholic elite ruling over a huge number of Buddhist peasants. In Iraq, you had a Ba'athist Sunni minority ruling over a majority of Shia as well as the Kurds. In Vietnam, the major direct combat operations didn't begin until we acted upon what turned out to be wrong intelligence and did not correct that intelligence, and that would forever stigmatize that particular involvement. In Iraq, in very similar circumstances, situation where we had intelligence that proved to be wrong in just about every respect that was important, it was not corrected right away, and that obviously dealt with the presence of WMD of various descriptions as well as a direct connection to Al-Qaeda. Both became largely guerrilla and asymmetric wars for which we were initially not well prepared. In both cases, we end up fighting an enemy that we couldn't differentiate from the civilian population. In Vietnam, when we were fighting the NVA, the North Vietnamese Army, they were much more regular troops. They weren't familiar with South Vietnam. They came and wore uniforms. They used more conventional tactics. We were able to confront them as we were trained to fight in previous wars where the more conventional tactics had been employed. The Viet Cong, on the other hand, blended in completely with the population. They all wore the what we call black pajamas. That you could not distinguish between the two during the daytime. And they resorted to what we then called booby traps, now called IEDs, in a later era. But most of their damage was done with guerrilla tactics, surprise attacks, and they did a lot of their work at night, and we eventually picked up a way to do that. Same problem in Iraq. As soon as the initial phase was over, the Iraqi army, to the extent that they had uniforms, shed those uniforms. To the extent they joined insurgents, you had another group, which was virtually indistinguishable, at least in the terms of appearance. You had outside powers in support of both operations, but you had global powers in Vietnam. You had Russia and the Warsaw Pact. You had a lot of concern about China, even though China and Vietnam were historical enemies. In Iraq, you had regional powers, Iran, Hezbollah, and others that were involved, but they were both supported by outside influence. With respect to Vietnam, let me say, first of all, I wanted very much to go to Vietnam. I'd had every great assignment that the Marine Corps has to offer. Greg was kind enough to mention that I had done reasonably well in the officer's basic school at Quantico, but I hadn't had my mettle tested in combat. In the 1958 Lebanon crisis, I'd been on a destroyer that was headed for Europe, and we got orders to divert to go into the Mediterranean and to Lebanon, but the situation was sufficiently resolved, and I didn't get a chance to go. In 1962, I was executive officer on the Marine Detachment on the USS Northampton, secret mission then. It was designed to provide a place for a president to fight a war against the Soviet Union. We'd had President Kennedy on 2 days with us out at sea. The entire Atlantic fleet had passed in review with 81 ships, a magnificent situation. When the Cuban Missile Crisis came along, however, we steamed up to Chesapeake Bay believing that we were going to pick up the president to come out and fight what we thought was going to be a nuclear war. And for several days, most of us thought we were going to finally see combat, particularly those of us who were young and naive at that particular point. In 1966, I'd been a general, the aide to the commanding general of the 2nd Marine Division. I won't give it detail, but another very good assignment. I had a short period of time before my next assignment, so I was with the most combat-ready BLT, ready to go to the Mediterranean. The Dominican Republic flap broke out. We thought we were going to go. They decided, no, they've got all of their preparations for engagement in the Mediterranean. We'll send them, and we'll send the next most combat-ready unit that came along. So in succeeding times, I had missed out. Then Vietnam was already a war, and I got sent up to the Marine Barracks, 8th and I. The ceremonial post of the Marine Corps was assigned as a social military aide to the White House. I was also in charge of the White House Color Guard. I got to do all of these great things. Most of my friends had been to Vietnam at least once, and I hadn't been, so I very much wanted to go. I spent the first half of my tour as a company commander, the second half of my tour when I got promoted to major as a assistant plans and operations G4. Lessons from Vietnam, just a couple. There are many, many lessons, but a couple that are hard to get away from. One, we cannot expect to win a protracted military conflict without the support of the American people. And second, we cannot win hearts and minds if we're killing innocent civilians indiscriminately with search and destroy missions or other less focused operations. Modern technology has changed everything. Many of you remember World War II, we had the movie tone that came on just before the Saturday matinee, and you had a sanitized version of the war. That's really all, and the press reporting was, for the most part, checked out. It was a very sanitized version in which the day-to-day reporting was much delayed, to say the least. Korea hadn't changed a whole lot. By Vietnam, you had a more aggressive media, a more independent media, but they still, and we had TV. There was no TV during the World War II, so you didn't have graphic images coming to you. In Vietnam, the images normally were at least a day late, so you were prepared for the fact that something was going to be very unpleasant. You were warned ahead of time that you might not want to watch these particular scenes, and a lot of that, too, was sanitized before it was presented. The media became very much more important during Vietnam, and by the time Iraq II, I won't even go into Gulf War I, which I did have an opportunity to visit at various different stages. But now every soldier and Marine can communicate on a daily basis, real-time communications with the folks back home. They know what's happening. They don't have to wait to hear it on the evening news. They can find out from their son or daughter who happens to be employed, and they can put their own spin on it. In fact, they can put it on YouTube, as we've now discovered, and you can actually see what they saw, or they'll send pictures that they take with their handsets that also provide pictures. It's a very different situation. We are immediately hit with the graphic details for which we are not, in many cases, prepared. Just a couple of other things. In Vietnam, we had the draft. Everyone felt affected by the war. Now we have what I would argue is the finest fighting force that this country or any country has ever had. That's one of the reasons we have it is because we don't have to take the malcontents. We don't take people that don't want to be there. They may not want to be there, but at least they want to be in the military, and they know that they have an obligation that might come along. It's easier on the commanders, from the president to the generals to the captains to the corporals, to control and lead troops who are there by their own choice than it is to do those who are there for some other means. It's been said in this particular instance that only two of the services, the two ground combat units, the Army and the Marine Corps, are really fully engaged in the war. The rest of the services, to the extent with smaller numbers, are participating superbly. But it's pretty much business as usual. And certainly back here at home, we don't have the urgency. We don't have any Rosie the Riveters. We don't have a sense of full engagement in the in the activities that are taking place. I can remember, as I suspect many of you, there's some World War II veterans perhaps in the crowd, but for those of us who were too small to be in the service at that time, I can remember all the coupons you had to save in order to get your sugar, your meat, whatever. You had to save your toothpaste tube to provide lead that would eventually go into the weapons, and it's you felt a part of it. Today, there's much more detachment. In Vietnam, everybody worried about events that were far away. I know for a fact, and that brings me to this, that everybody from the president on down in the chain of command anguished daily about bombing missions and missing pilots. The gentleman depicted in that particular frame frequently would go late at night, after midnight, with his daughter Lucy, who'd converted to Catholicism, to visit what he called the little monks, to pray about things that were happening, or that he knew were happening, that the rest of the public didn't know, but about which he had given orders, and there was a very direct involvement. My wife, whom I left behind, she and I knew that we were expecting. The rest of the world didn't until sometime later on. But she couldn't sleep because she could hear the daily, virtually around-the-clock demonstrations, the anti-war demonstrations, right outside the White House. She went back to live with her parents during this particular period of time. So it was a difficult time. This picture, I didn't know it at the time, but the president had asked to read some of my letters, and he eventually asked if he could listen to the tapes, and then he decided he would play them for the cabinet. This was after he played a particular tape that we cannot find now. The library has searched for it and everything else, but you can see the anguish in his face, if I recall correctly, that this brought to him and other members of the cabinet had told me since how this affected them. So it was hitting very close to home for everybody that was involved. Today we have a war that is staged in many respects, particularly by our wily adversaries, for the benefit of the media. They know that they don't have to have a large success in terms of a military operation. What they need to do is have something that they can put on their television and on our television to create hate and discontent among both our people and reinforcement for their own cause and their own people. I think, in closing, that embedded reporters are a very good idea, because you get a lot better feel for what's happening, a feel that you can't get, and I won't go into this here, but in the green zone, it's a very different world. In our last group, I had a chance to go out to Anbar province, and I had a chance also to go to the Dora subdivision, both of the areas which are central to the activity that's taking place. It's not like that in the green zone, and the people in the green zone seldom get out of it, and so it's a very different situation. If the reporters go out on their own, provide real-time experiences and real-time information, we get a much better picture of what's actually happening, and anyone who's involved in policy in the war has to be able to take this into account when presenting how's it going, knowing that everybody's got a way of presenting the truth, and if they shade that a little bit, they're going to get in trouble. With that, I have presented just enough grist, I hope, to get you started, and I thank you for that opportunity.
Thank you very much, Senator Robb. It's a pleasure to welcome everyone here on behalf of the Miller Center. This conference, the 2000 SIAG conference, is going to be focusing on homegrown terrorism and the global war on terror. In this opening session, to be moderated by Margaret Warner, we're looking at a topic that Dr. Satoff calls Root, Stem, and Branch, Homegrown Radicals and the Limits of Terrorism. And we've assembled around the round table this afternoon a group of experts from around the world. I'd like to just briefly go around the room and give a summary introduction. And as I introduce each of our participants, I would ask that they stand so that others in the room will know who they are. The Lord Alderdice is a practicing psychiatrist and politician. He has served as Speaker of the Northern Ireland Assembly and is a winner of the John F. Kennedy Profiles in Courage Award, among many honors, for his longtime commitment to political conflict resolution. Welcome, Lord Alderdice. Scott Atran is an anthropologist whose work on the limits of reason and the role of religion in modern society has sparked considerable controversy and was the subject of the March 4, 2007 New York Times Sunday Magazine lead article. His recent work has examined the ideology and social evolution of transnational terrorism. Thank you, Scott. Chris Dawson is the Deputy Commissioner of the Western Australian Police, where he oversees counterterrorism activities. Ajit Doval joined the Indian Police Service after earning a master's degree in economics and worked as a career intelligence official for over 33 years. In January 2005, he retired as director of the Intelligence Bureau. Thank you. Rafi Khachaturian, who spoke here at the Miller Center 2 weeks ago, is a graduate of Trinity College who holds a master's in international relations from Columbia University. He's been on the editorial staff of The New Yorker since 2003, and his long article, Azam the American, about Californian Adam Gadon, appeared in the January issue of that magazine. Colonel Pat Lang is retired from the United States Army, where he served in military intelligence and the special forces. While serving in the Defense Intelligence Agency, he frequently briefed the President of the United States on intelligence matters. Dr. Amina Beverly McLeod is a professor of Islamic studies in the Department of Religious Studies at DePaul University, and she's a leading authority on African American Islam. Edwin Meese III served as Attorney General of the United States and on the National Security Council. He served on the Iraq Study Group and is now serving on the National War Powers Commission. Philip Mudd, whose plane is late and will be arriving late, is the Associate Executive Assistant Director of the National Security Branch of the FBI. He joined the CIA in 1985 and served as Deputy Director of the DCI Counterterrorism Center before assuming his present position in the FBI. Mark Sageman holds a medical degree and a PhD in sociology. He joined the CIA in 1984. Since 1994, he's been in the private practice of clinical and forensic psychiatry and has evaluated about 500 murderers. Since 9/11, he's been collecting biographical material on about 400 Al-Qaeda terrorists and consults regularly with various branches of the United States government. Finally, our moderator, Margaret Warner, is one of three senior correspondents on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. Previously, she spent 10 years at Newsweek and was chief diplomatic correspondent during the end of the Cold War and the collapse of the Soviet Union and the first Gulf War. She's a graduate of Yale and currently serves as a member of the Yale Corporation. It's a pleasure to introduce the participants and Margaret Warner. Williger, former Assistant Attorney General of the United States and presently in private practice.
Well, George, I think George Terwilliger thought that would mean he wouldn't have to speak. Welcome to everyone. As George Gillum just explained, this whole conference is going to look at the phenomenon of homegrown terrorism, and what we'd like to do at this session is just get the phenomenon sort of out on the table, and then everyone around here is going to spend the next couple of days looking at some fascinating case studies. It seems to me there is a bit of a paradox, and this is what I'd like us to examine just in our maybe fairly brief opening comments, which is, on the one hand, we have not seen in the United States another attack, a spectacular attack like 9/11, in now over 5 years. There have been some very serious attacks elsewhere, London, Madrid, Bali, India, to name a few. And the government's own reports suggest that, in fact, the threat of terrorism or the incidence of terrorism is, in fact, up. Now, the State Department does an annual terrorism report every April. Unfortunately, we are just 3 weeks in advance of the new one. But the one that came out last April looked at 05 and found a 400% increase worldwide in the number of terror incidents. Now, that was not a perfect corollary because they used a slightly different data collection method. In addition, 30% of attacks had occurred in Iraq. So if you took those out, but still if you took those out, and even with the other caveat, there is no doubt that the incidence of terror is increasing. So the question is, what is the state of homegrown terrorism? How has it changed in the last 5 years? How, in particular, what is the relationship between it and the global war on terror, which most of the world's governments and law enforcement authorities have been engaged in the last 5 years? So I'd like to kind of whip around the room quickly at first in a way for everyone to hear your voices and your perspectives. We've got people here with very broad understanding of this problem and people with very country-specific, as I'm sure you could tell from the brief bios, with particular specialties. But Mark Sageman, let me begin with you. What is your sense of the state of homegrown terrorism in the world today, and has it increased in the last 5 years?
The way I look at the problem is that it was always homegrown. The only difference between pre-9/11 and now is that Al-Qaeda had an address. So people were able to connect with Al-Qaeda, whereas now it's much more difficult for them to do so, with the exception of the British, because they have family in Azad Kashmir. They all come from Azad Kashmir. Well, vast majority comes from Azad Kashmir. So I want to preface that. Now, in order to answer the question in terms of the effect of Iraq on this, we have to really understand the process by which people get radicalized and get mobilized into terrorism. And the way I see it, it's a four-pronged process. One is a sense of moral outrage. And here, Iraq really plays into this. The second is that it has to be interpreted, this moral outrage has to be interpreted by a specific ideology. In this case, the ideology is it's a war on Islam. The reason why this ideology sticks to people is that it often resonates with their personal experience. That's the third prong. And this is the reason why we have not had an attack here in the United States, whereas Europe is in trouble. The reason is we have very different communities who are facing very different opportunities in the labor market in Europe and the United States.
Very different Muslim.
That's correct. Very different Muslim community. So if it resonates with their personal experience, this ideology, it's a war on Islam, very much predominates. Up to now, we just have some angry Muslim who really don't know what to do. The fourth prong is that they're mobilized by a network. And the network, before 9/11, simply because of coincidence in terms of the state of technology, was very much face-to-face. It was often in the vicinity of radical mosques. Now it is no longer the case. Now the radicalization process takes place in chat rooms on the internet. And you have a spreading of people who are radicalized mentally. We now have the opportunity to do something. So coming back to Iraq is now almost the reason that people give when they arrest them, why they do what they do in terms of, you know, whether it's 7/7 London or a lot of people arrested in Europe. Iraq has definitely poured fuel on this.
So you think, just to clarify, you think it is more the war in Iraq than just simply the focus of the world, the global war on terror? that is a sort of point of used as an inspirational tool.
That is correct. Let me also point out that Iraq did not cause terrorism. It did not, you know, cause this, but it definitely poured fuel into this. There was some indication that this movement was fading away after 9/11, and it really kind of had a resurgence. So when you compare 2004, 2003, you see a resurgence after Iraq because of the moral outrage.
What's your sense of the impact of both the global war on terror? And yeah. I was going to hold back on the war in Iraq, but it's on the table.
Sure. Well, you know, it's I usually agree with what the things Mark says, that this isn't an exception, but I could add something to this. In fact, there's been a kind of basic misapprehension about the nature of the way Muslims organize themselves to do things generally. The sort of Christmas tree lines of communication that we're so used to, you know, in which you have chains of command, things like that, only rarely exist in Islamic situations. And usually they're the result of colonial experience, foreign teaching of some kind or other, things like that. Normally things are done on the basis of networked consensus groups, groups of people who come together to come to agreements as to what it is they think should be done in various places. So, as Mark says, the phenomenon of takfiri or jihadi activity existed before the Iraq thing went on, and Al-Qaeda provided us with a place to go look for the leaders in Afghanistan and places like that. And it is, in my opinion, and it's just everything here practically is going to be opinion, is the phenomenon that underlies this is the fact that there are many Muslims in the world who, in fact, still think in terms of exclusivist groups, in terms of themselves as one community and other people as a different community. And so, and along that line, the radicals tend to preach to them about the difference in hostility of the non-Muslim group against them. So there, before 9/11, there was a fairly small group of people who did this kind of thing, but post 9/11, after the war in Afghanistan and then the war in Iraq, it was easy, in the way Mark was saying, to preach this to people because you could point to these things as evidence of what was claimed to be the hostility of the West and the America as the leader of the West against Islam, the Dar al-Islam, the world of Islam, the supposed future theocratic kingdom on earth, you know, the Ummah. And so we have, in fact, I think, built that up. But as was said here, the nature of Islamic life in the United States is very different than it is in places in Europe, where people think of themselves in a more exclusivist, sort of ethnic nationalist kind of way, in such a way that someone who is an immigrant to the United States, whose ancestors have lived here for 40, 50, 60 years, knows it is hard, in fact, that he can go out and get a job, he can go to a reasonable school, and he can be accepted into American life. And I think that makes a tremendous difference in the potential for homegrown terrorism, if that's what we're calling it here, whereas it's very high in other places. And I think you'd have to say that the Iraqi adventure has, in fact, thrown fuel on the fire that enables preachers to work on these people.
Let me go to Chris Dawson from Australia. And Mr. Dawson, tell us your sort of country-specific sense of domestic terrorism.
Margaret, in 1978 is probably the first homegrown...
If everyone pull their mics close
Sorry.
Enough, so, yeah, everyone...
In 1978, there was a homegrown, radicalised Australian who was connected with a Hilton Hotel bombing in Sydney. That was probably the first incident in recent memory that Australia, I guess, was shaken by a bombing. But in the Australian landscape and in the Southeast Asian region, the issue of terrorism really only came to the fore in 2002 and the subsequent bombing in Bali, Indonesia in 2005. And while that was not on Australian soil, there were some 92 Australians killed in those two bombings. That very much sharpened the focus for Australians in the sense that that was a very popular holiday place for Australians. The fact that the Australians were actually targeted and were named as targets and subsequent casualties has really sharpened the focus for Australia. And so in that sense, that has really been a catalyst for bringing it to the fore and causing quite a great deal of concern.
Thank you. But within Australia itself, do you have a rising threat of whether they're converts or first or second generation immigrants within Australia?
There are presently two major trials occurring in Sydney and Melbourne, and those persons are of ethnic descent, although there is at least one Caucasian that is amongst the persons accused of these crimes. And they are still on foot as trials, but they have again heightened the issues for Australia in the sense that these persons are alleged to be in possession of precursors to cause explosions. And while those trials are still underway, that again has been a matter of great interest to the Australian community.
Ajit Daval, of course, India has its own set of issues and own problems with terrorism before all of this, for sure. Can you say now that the bombings, I'm just thinking of the ones most recently, the subway bombings, that they are connected to this global struggle we're seeing, or is it still fairly particular, India, Pakistan, Kashmir, those set of issues?
Actually, the Indian experience of terrorism will have to be understood in a slightly wider context. The South Asian context, which is a home of about one-third of the entire Muslim population in the world. This is an area which has contributed the largest number of jihadis in the contemporary jihadic framework, which has also suffered the largest number of casualties on account of jihadi war. And India has got the largest Muslim population in this South Asian region. India has got the second largest Muslim population in the world, second only to Indonesia. And no Indian Muslim has joined international terrorism. Now you have to understand this contradiction. We have the highest number of terrorist victims, about 40,000 killed, mostly in Kashmir, but also outside Kashmir. Most of the people who came and indulge in these acts of terrorism came from outside. And except within Kashmir, when some people joined them, 150 million Muslims never made a common cause with this so-called jihadi warfare in Kashmir. Now, when we say that, that to what extent our domestic factor has been responsible for discourse management, because we see something very wrong about the whole phenomenon. Every conflict that involves a Muslim is getting converted into a Muslim conflict, as an Islamic conflict. This is the strategy of the radicals. They tried their best to project conflict in Kashmir as an Islamic conflict. And India's effort was that it might be any kind, it may be legal, it may be political, it may be military, it may be geopolitical, it may be bilateral, it may be anything. But it is not Islamic. So the discourse creation and discourse management is extremely important for us. Because if we have to delegitimize the pernicious ideologies which are associated with Islam, we will have to first de-Islamize those ideologies. If they are linked to Islam, it will be a very, very difficult task. It was a deliberate effort in Kashmir and a long struggle. That is, we said that we may be wrong, there may be human rights violations, that's an issue, there may be unemployment, there may be political problems of the Muslims there, but it is not an Islamic issue. It is not an issue versus the Muslims versus the non-Muslims. Because the moment it becomes that, then 150 million Muslims of India also are part of that. And then the global, this thing of the entire global this thing. Now today, this connectivity, the convergence, that is emerging, that every local issue in which a Muslim is involved, whether it's a road accident, it's a property dispute, or it is this thing, tends to become a convergence of issue of the Muslims of the world as a whole. And this is what the Islamic radicals are doing to us. And we are also getting engaged by countering it on the same terms, trying to fight the battle on the same terms. We have got to learn, or we have got to evolve a new strategy for the discourse management. So that has been the Indian experience of radicalism, the terrorism. That is, we don't have it as a homegrown terrorism. It is essentially a proxy war by a neighboring country for a political piece of land, which is a disputed piece of land. That can be seen how it is sorted out. It's more a military matter than probably a matter of terrorism.
Lord Alderdice, I saw you nodding as he was speaking.
I think one of the side effects and dangers of speaking about the difficulties we have in terms of a global war on terror is it precisely feeds into the kind of problem that our Indian colleague is speaking about, where you're either for us or against us, and if there's some Muslims are bombing us, then we must be against all Muslims. And it feeds precisely into the line that the extreme Islamists take. So both sides, I think, are finding themselves playing into this. And it's always what happens. This kind of polarization is what happens once the violence starts. From our point of view at home, of course, the terrorism was in that sense homegrown. And I'd like to pick up on that and on some of Mark Sageman's comments, because I think they're important in understanding this question of why there hasn't been another 9/11. People who espouse terrorism as a tactic are not committed to terrorism per se. This is a particular tactic of asymmetric warfare, which for various reasons is useful to that group of people at that particular time. And the background to the engagement was a sense of many people who weren't simply Muslims, but they were Muslims in the Middle East, who had a particular experience of what was happening there, who felt it was unjust, were deeply unhappy over a period of more than half a century, and found that other ways of attending to the problem wasn't to their satisfaction, and they began to take to the use of terrorism and to learn from the tactical experiences of others who had used this technique. Now, the main purpose of it is really is to drive the West out of the Middle East in order that people in the Middle East can get on with running their own part of the world, because their sense is that the West has, from the time of Britain and France particularly, had, from their point of view, an unhappy involvement with their region, an intrusive and authoritarian involvement with their region. So if they use the tactic of 9/11, and it was massively successful, not in terms of the number of people who were killed, that's not the point of the exercise, but in focusing the world's attention and in focusing America's attention, it was massively successful. They don't need to do another 9/11 at the moment. Why? Because they're now engaged directly with the United States of America in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and in other places. And so if they can engage directly in asymmetric warfare, which is working to their advantage, then they don't particularly need to have another 9/11. They're not particularly espousing that. That's a sort of silly, mistaken view. So they don't need anything of that kind. They're already engaged. And by the way, they're engaged and believe that they're winning. They believe themselves to be successful in that regard. And that particular success in a kind of on-the-ground involvement directly with military forces has been greatly supported and strengthened by the outcome of the South Lebanon War, where Hezbollah engaged directly with the IDF and were, in their terms, extremely successful. And I think there are some very interesting things about the tactics that they used there. In terms of the intelligence war, they were successful against Israel in a way that had not been the case before. In terms of how they used rockets and how they hid them, they were very successful. In terms of the unsuccessful nature of the use of tanks by the IDF, it probably was the most striking example for 50 years or more of how tanks can be defeated in an upfront way. There are a whole series of ways in which it's felt to be successful, and therefore there's no immediate need for them to engage in terrorist tactics in the same kind of way. So I think that's the thing that's important, is get away from thinking of terrorism as though that described the problem, either in terms of the reasons for it, or indeed the use of tactics. That's one tactic out of the armory, but there are lots of others, and at the moment they feel themselves to be quite successful on the ground in Iraq and elsewhere in the region, so they don't need to engage in the other things. But they may do somewhere along the line. And I would just say this, don't feel too comforted about the fact that there are not things happening here, for two reasons. First of all, the reason the UK and France in particular, but also much of the rest of Europe, has an issue is because in the post-colonial period you had a massive number of people from those parts of the world coming to live there. There was not a problem of that kind of terrorism for the first generation or two. And there's a very interesting question that I think we probably will come on to later in this, and that is, why is it not first-generation people? It's second, third, and fourth-generation people who are fully integrated, who are not poverty-stricken, who are well-educated, very often married, integrated into the community, and they're the people who get involved. And I think it's a very interesting question of why that's the case, and it's very important because it means that simple social and economic integration does not necessarily, in the long term, address the problem. And it's one of the big struggles we have in Europe at the moment.
Mark Sageman. I'm sorry. Not Mark Sageman. Scott. I'm staring at Mark, but I mean Scott Atran. You two have worked together so much, but Mark's already spoken. So
let me just try to reframe a little bit. First, terrorism, as we're talking about it, poses no strategic threat whatsoever to the United States. Never will. In the height of the Cold War, there were about 125,000 nuclear weapons, each one on average more powerful than Hiroshima. If these guys got it together in their wildest dreams, that is, if everything clicked, maybe one or two of these things kill up to 200,000 people. That's a lot of people, maximum, but it could never, never pose a serious threat to the United States' social or economic infrastructure. It would be the reaction of the United States which posed its own threat. And as far as the people themselves who are joining terrorism around the world, I'm talking about from the jungles of Sulawesi and Borneo to the suburbs of Paris or Madrid or the Jemaah Mazuat quarter of Tetuan. They are, as you said, there's no Christmas tree command and control. These are mostly young men looking for some meaning in life. And the Quran and ideology has very little to do with it. It's part of a massive transnational political awakening driven by the media in which these young people are finding meaning in life that they hadn't found before. And what you find is, of the millions of people who are sympathetic to the jihad, very, very few actually commit violence. And the ones who commit violence usually do so because they're friends, they grew up in the same neighborhood together, they decided to come in a bunch. And there's no particular ideological difference between the ones who do it and the ones who don't, except that they played on soccer teams or they grew up in the same housing project. I mean, we were just in the Jemaah Mazuat in Tetuan. Had no suicide. There was nothing from Morocco. Just in the past couple of years, five of the seven guys who blew themselves up in Leganés in Madrid came from the same barrio, the same quarter. Some of them had no religious experience whatsoever. Some of them were candy salesmen who just admired the guys who did get involved. And in that same neighborhood, that just a few blocks from one another, you've got 30 suicide bombers about that have gone to Iraq in the last year or so. 11 have been identified by DNA. But if you try to figure out why these guys, you go to the mosque, you're not going to find anything. You look for Al-Qaeda recruiters, there's no Al-Qaeda there. You go to the Chicago Cafe on Abdul Karim Khatabi Street, and there you'll see the guy schmoozing and trying to find some kind of meaning in life to get. And so I think the jihad, in one sense, is not a threat at all. But because it's such a different threat than we commonly conceive it, we're reacting to it in crazy ways. We have an expression in French, you don't use a boxing glove to kill a fly. Well, we're using tanks and cruise missiles to blow holes for the breeding grounds for these kinds of things.
All right, on that provocative note, Mr. Gillum is telling me we're taking a break. And, we will leave that pregnant thought hanging and be back in 5 minutes.
All right, well, let's pick up where Scott left off, and also, I mean, everybody's comments, but and Lord Alterdice's as well, about how we shouldn't be complacent in this country. But George Terwilliger, you wanted to pick right up on what Scott had to say.
Thank you, Margaret. What I'd like to do is put the assessment of our current vulnerability into a little bit of historical perspective, picking up on what Senator Robb said about the importance of history. And then respectfully disagree with Scott's conclusion.
Just in time. Good.
If you look back over the last half of the 20th century, we did have homegrown terrorism in the United States in the form of domestic radical organizations who opposed government policies and, picking up on what Lord John said, adopted terror as a tactic to try to influence government policy as well as public opinion. And there were serious incidents of bombing courthouses, killing police officers, and engaging in other acts of violence. When terrorism became a tactic for the use by some Middle Eastern groups, first overseas, the United States was a victim in the Marine barracks in 1983, embassy bombings later, attacks on military targets like the Cole, and then, of course, there was the attacks here. I was the prosecutor in 1986, the very first time, at least reported time, that a Middle Eastern terrorist group attempted to smuggle an IED into the United States. That group, which actually came out of a Syrian-Lebanese connection, did have a large support infrastructure in the United States. We had domestic radicals of Muslim extremists, a Hanafi Muslim sect, who in the mid-1970s took over three buildings in Washington, D.C., occupied them, killed a number of people in the process. All of this escalated to the point where 9/11 happened. When 9/11 happened, one of the things that I think we recognized is that all that had occurred before that domestically had proven the vulnerability of our infrastructure. We knew we did not have a hard target here. We have responded in some ways by hardening the target and adopting a tactical approach of taking our war to them over there. Now, both Scott and Lord John make some very good points in terms of the tactical value of terrorism is meant to serve a purpose. And, of course, you'd have to be idiotic not to understand and agree with that. But I can't agree with Scott when he says, in a very provocative way, that there is no strategic threat to the United States except our own reaction to terrorism, particularly domestically. The reaction to terrorism in the United States is not going to be driven by policy. It's going to be driven by politics. That is to say, it's going to be driven by what the people demand occur. What the people demanded occur after 9/11 was that we not let that happen again. And I agree that we should not be complacent by the fact that it has not happened again. I think there are a variety of reasons, some we can take credit for and some that are the tactical situation. But we would make a great mistake to assume a level of complacency about the challenge that lays before us, which I'll close with two thoughts about that challenge. Number one, it's great because, as Senator Robb said about the enemy in Vietnam and Iraq, could very well be the situation here. It could become impossible to differentiate the enemy who is embedded here in the United States from our own civilian population. And secondly, because we are a free society that is constitutionally based and that values its civil liberties as much as anything else, the challenge to us to respond to that circumstance is going to be one that is going to require the greatest deal of creativity and self-discipline that we could possibly imagine on the domestic side.
Well, let's examine how great the threat is here in the United States of, and when I say homegrown, I think just because it's such a huge topic anyway, if we can really focus on terrorism perpetrated by people who live in the country, as opposed to people who sneak into the country to commit an act of terrorism. And Amina McLeod, let me ask you, how vulnerable do you think the United States is to having the growth of homegrown radicalism, some of which might express itself through terrorism?
Big question. Well, I kind of agree with everybody, I think. I think we should not be complacent because we just should not be complacent. But I also think that the social atmosphere here is very different than, say, Europe or even Australia. And some of those past things that George was mentioning are indeed shaping how terror, if it comes again, will be experienced here. But one of the things that is on the horizon is what we're doing to young Muslims, both from immigrant families and from U.S. families, as they grow in a society now where the religion of their parents and of themselves is evil. And these young
you mean
people...
evil that they're regarded as evil by the...
By their classmates, by teachers who are teaching them, it's the attitude in the classroom, it's the attitude of their coworkers, and they're growing in an atmosphere where the one thing almost now you can't admit to being is Muslim. There are parameters that are not easily discernible as to answers for what kind of Muslim are you. So I think that that is a slow-growing problem. But on the other hand, differing from both Europe and Australia and perhaps even India, is the sense by many of those who live in America that they're as scared of terrorism as other Americans are. Chose to come to the United States because of the absence of a colonial legacy, only to find themselves being followed by some ideologies that they thought they had left at home. I think given the diversity of the population and typical problem-solving methods here, how it works itself out is going to be a little different, but it does not mean that we're not vigilant. And we have some cases that we're going to look at in the next few days, which I think will bring that to light. The kind of networking that is in Europe especially, some of it is here. It is not here in the same way because the proclivities of the people are very different. In the African-American community, for example, the Muslims are listening to the woes of the Muslim world. They hear them, but they don't have an experience of them. They can support some things but not others. They're not clear. You know, they listen to Arab Muslims complain about the Israeli-Palestinian situation, but their experience of the Jewish population is very different. So there's I hear it, I understand what you're saying, I don't know it, however. They're more likely, and you can look at that in terms of organizations, look at the fact that African-American Muslims, white American Muslims, some Latino Muslims are more likely to go to the ACLU or the NAACP to, well, I'll take you to court, how dare you do X, Y, and Z, as opposed to then going into networking to blow up something. And they're definitely not blowing up their neighborhoods because their mothers will get them. You know, it's we've been there, we've done that, we've blown up neighborhoods, they've never been rebuilt, we're not doing that one again. So you have a different attitude, a different probably lack of vision, and some would say, getting used to the global picture, others would say, and where it goes really depends on what we do now.
Rafi Khachaturian, let me bring you into this now, and I hope all of you got a chance to read his superb piece on Azam the American, as it was called, a young man in California who went from being Adam to being Azam and who is now with Al-Qaeda. Though I thought it was interesting that he is not operational in the United States. So let me ask you about that. At the very end of your piece, and I don't want to step on your conversation tomorrow because I know it's one of the case studies here, but what lessons did you draw about the pathways to radicalization, and how significant did you find it that when he was asked, according to your reporting, to be part of actually coming back here and doing some sort of an operation in Maryland, he declined, saying, well, no, I have a wife and a baby, and he didn't.
Well, I mean, some of the things that were of interest to me, some of the conclusions that were surprising to me, fit with some of the work that Mark Sageman has done, and I point that out in the piece, which is that my initial assumptions about what this individual was like on the beginning of his journey into this jihadist movement were somewhat different than what the facts presented, which is that he seemed at first to be a loner, and if you've read the piece, you might know why that is the case. But he actually, the process by which he seems to become radicalized was very much in a kinship, in a friendship, group atmosphere. So that to me was an interesting conclusion. I'm sorry, what was the other?
Well, just that he at the same time.
Oh, yeah,
he and then, went well, there, but he didn't come back here then.
The thing to realize about Adam Gadahn is that the process, the tactic of terrorism, is about presenting a message. And, you know, that message can be conveyed through video. It can be conveyed through acts of violence. And, you know, one of the things that I wanted to bring to the discussion also is in talking about this social movement, it's probably useful to keep in mind that there are a wide range of opinions, and that just as we sit here and maybe agree or disagree, among jihadists, there are very intense discussions about strategy and how to approach that. And there's a guy there's a guy named Abu Bakr Naji, who is of unknown identity, but supposed either to be Jordanian or Tunisian. And in 2004, in thinking about the future of Al-Qaeda, he wrote a piece called The Management of Savagery. And part of what he was saying is that Al-Qaeda is sort of losing its public relations war, and that it needs to explain its actions through the language of militant Islam, but nonetheless explain them better. And it has to communicate that justification clearly to the masses as they understood it. And so I think that piece also expresses a sort of broader line of thinking that runs through the jihadi community. And it's not surprising that you see Adam Gadahn, who's of key importance in this because he's an American and he can sort of speak the language of Americans, or at least tries to, and you see that his videos become more prominently circulated, basically, you know, around after that time. 2006, I think, was when the majority of his videos were released.
So in other words, he feels he can spread the message in a way that he's particularly talented at doing,
but also
because of his command of English and because he's an American in part.
But also you see, I think last year there were 21 videos, audio tapes and videos by either Bin Laden or Zawahiri, which is twice the number that preceded it in the year before. So it's not just Adam Gadahn's videos in isolation. I think you're just seeing a more robust media campaign on the part of Al-Qaeda.
I wanted to welcome Philip Mudd, who you were introduced in absentia earlier, but we're so glad you can join us. And I thought, I saw when you came in, but I thought by now maybe you would have a sense of where the conversation was going. So could you weigh in on this? So you have a good overview of the state and threat of homegrown terrorism here in the United States and where it is right now.
I think that there are a couple of things that are intersecting. The first is something we saw emerge in the beginnings of Al-Qaeda, an organization that wants to be known and identifies itself as the base. the base being that organization that doesn't want to conduct every attack as it, like the attacks it conducted in 1998 in East Africa or the Cold Bombing, but would like to inspire others to think and act as they do. So you have an ideological piece that I think we're seeing bloom now in the 15 years after the Sudan experience. And that is, if you look at youth in French youth, for example, in France, Algerian and Moroccan youth in France, or North Africans in Spain, second-generation Pakistanis or Bangladeshis in Britain, I think they have come to see the world, even if they've never met an al-Qaeda person, as al-Qaeda would want them to see the world. The most dangerous thing to me here in this war is not weapons, it's not explosives, it's the idea that you can attack in this country and that the killing of innocents is acceptable for this cause. So the first piece is a success of al-Qaeda. The second and final thing I would say that I think is disturbing, I'm not a sociologist or psychologist, Mark might have some better thoughts, is that the cases that I see since I have joined the Bureau now about 19 months ago show vulnerable kids. We think of this as a terrorist phenomenon, an al-Qaeda phenomenon, a Saudi-based phenomenon, but I think of it in terms of watching revolution among kids in the 1960s, bell-bottoms in the 1970s. I see the way they talk, which is a language of youth talking to each other in terms that you would not recognize. They have a common sort of hip language to talk about jihad. So I think the combination of the success of al-Qaeda in spreading its message and the classic vulnerability of youth make me believe we're in for a long haul here. And a lot of the cases I see are not high-end al-Qaeda cases. A 17-year-old kid who is socializing with a friend of his, and they're starting to talk about jihad like it's fun and interesting.
And why do you think we have not seen attacks of the nature that we have in Europe?
I struggle with this question, but I'll give you a quick, believe it or not, response. I think there are three rings of success. The first is the offensive taken immediately after 9/11 by CIA, by law enforcement, by U.S. military, and by security service partners overseas. There is a hidden war out there and a partnership among security services that rarely appears and that is not vulnerable to political and diplomatic problems. And having seen that from the CIA perspective, that's a very successful war. So the first is taking the offense to the enemy where the enemy lives. And I think most critically, the loss of safe haven for al-Qaeda is important. Second is the defensive perimeter around this country. The first ring takes you out to Pakistan, Afghanistan. The second is things like biometric passports and hardening cockpit doors, name checks for airlines. The most expensive and inefficient form of protecting this country, but very effective. And I know the enemy, our adversary, thinks about this more than we know. They talk about it a lot, how difficult it is to get here. And finally, the third ring, if you go at them where they are and try to protect this country from them getting in, once they get here, local law enforcement, the FBI, we are very aggressive in ways we could not have been 6 years ago to look at people once we find them here. And finally, the amount of resources we're using to look at people who might have fallen off the radar 6 years ago is a remarkable transformation in law enforcement. So it's overseas with the security perimeter, it's here with DHS around the margins of this country, and it's inside the country with law enforcement, I think.
How vulnerable do you think this country is to really home-generated terrorism at this point?
Well, I agree with Lord Alderdice that you should not be complacent, because we were fairly complacent prior to 9/11. And I would say that if you took a poll of people at that time, could something like this happen here, they would have said no. Likewise, when in 1993, when we had the first bombing in the Twin Towers, everybody thought of that more as a crime, as a law enforcement situation, rather than warfare. And it wasn't until the 2001 event that we talked about being at war. One of the things that concerns me, and why I disagree in part with Scott in the sense that terrorism is not a strategic threat to the United States, except how we react. It is the way in which we react that I think makes it a strategic threat, because people in the United States do not expect to have these kinds of things happen. We went for years without anything like this while bombings and other things were taking place in other countries and terrorist attacks. The worst terrorist attack we had prior to 9/11 was the Symbionese Liberation Army in California, where officials were executed and assassinated and things like that were happening. And that was short-lived, but nevertheless, it created a lot of havoc. But we saw in the study that we did in 2003 on the sniper incident here how a very little bit of terror can create a tremendous reaction. And so I think that in that sense, I would be concerned about what might happen and why I think that the resources and the defenses that Philip Mudd talked about are extremely necessary. But there is, once you go through a period of time when there are no incidents, then you will have political pushback against the kind of things he's talking about. And we get a considerable amount of that taking place right now, as we see in the Congress and elsewhere. And that, to me, is one of our vulnerabilities that I think creates one of the greatest dangers. One thing that has interested me, and that is in the anti-war demonstrations, you don't seem, and maybe I may be wrong, maybe I just haven't observed it, but you don't see much of a Muslim component in the demonstrations against the Iraq war. And that would indicate that whatever is happening, it may well be, there may well be, and there have been cases of material support found within the Muslim community. There have been, supposedly, there's at least stories of propaganda through madrasas and elsewhere. But that seems not to have come out into widespread public activity that would indicate that this is a source. On the other hand, what Philip Mudd said about the vulnerable youth, this conceivably could occur in terms of the mobilization and agitation of people outside the Muslim community that could be drawn into potential terrorist activities as well, as we've seen in the past. So I think that certainly we are not in any position to let our guard down, and I think that we have to make sure that that there is a reasonable understanding of the importance of keeping up these activities against what I think will be political forces trying to change things.
Scott, you've been mentioned by so many people. Do you want to jump in here just on general principles, or shall I give you a question?
Well, let me just say one thing about the strategic threat. So I'm not sure if people are saying, yes, this is a strategic threat caused by terrorism itself or by the reaction. I think it is a psychological threat to the United States, because of something we could call the jerk effect, which is why statistics don't matter. That is, when a sudden event happens that you're not psychologically ready for, you respond in not rational actor ways of which we're responding. But look, compare the Muslim population of Western Europe to the United States. Roughly the same general population.
The same number of general population.
Same number of people.
Number.
A third of the European.
But it's a much greater proportion of the European.
All right. In Muslim prisons, you have, depending on the prison, 60 to 90% of the prison population is Muslim.
Maximum. In Europe?
In Europe. In Western Europe. About 8% of the population maximum. And many of the problems that African Americans have in prisons that come out of, say, American ghettos are similar problems that Muslims have in Europe. In United States prisons, Muslims are often underrepresented relative to their population, like Jews are, and it's not a threat that grows within Muslim populations itself. There doesn't seem to be much of a threat, actually, in terms of, say, prison populations. And in the United States, regardless of governments, the social fabric of the United States is built to handle immigrant communities. You pay property taxes, and you pay for your local schools, and your local schools are going to be sensitive to who's paying the property taxes. So you'll have Muslim Awareness Day or Eskimo Awareness Day, depending on who's paying the property taxes. In Europe, in France, for example, you have the prime minister saying, the former prime minister, who introduced secular education, I know what every teacher in every school and every village is doing and teaching in France today. That leaves very little room for integration. And again, as someone pointed out, it's only since World War II and in Spain since the death of Franco that you've got massive immigration into societies. Most of it is being handled top down with the president of France saying, oh, we need some imams here to moderate, oh, we need some structures here, some housing over here, and it's been a disaster. And so you have the third generation completely lost, again, finding meaning. You don't have this in the United States. I mean, it could happen. And you do have, as you say, this language of youth forming, and people, we do see it, but nothing like in Europe, where you see it in every single suburb, in every single city in Western Europe, and it is a real, real problem as the children dream of either becoming Osama bin Laden or soccer stars like Ronaldinho.
Do you agree with that, Lord Alderdice?
I think there are certainly differences between Europe and the United States, but there are also enormous differences within Europe. I mean, for example, if you take the educational question in France, it couldn't be more different than Britain in that regard, where, for example, the recent moves by the Prime Minister in the UK have been to establish more faith-based schools, including Islamic schools. Very different in France, where you've had the whole row about the wearing of the hijab, for example. So I think it's not appropriate to look at Europe as though it was all one entity. It's a very variegated place. But one thing that a lot of Europe does have, particularly Western Europe, countries like Britain and France and the Netherlands and Belgium in particular, because of their wide colonial spread in the past, have over the past 50 years had very large numbers of immigrants coming in to what they expected was actually the mother country because of the imperial experience. That's very different from immigrants coming to the United States who don't ever regard the United States as being, it might be an aspiration, but it's not seen as being the mother country. But for many people who came from the Indian subcontinent to Britain, it was because they and their grandparents and their great-grandparents had looked to Britain or had looked to France or whatever because of the imperial past. So I think you've differences there which are important to keep in mind.
Hasn't one major difference, though, in Britain been that you did really have the radical imam problem, that for quite a long time the British government more than tolerated very radical imams who really preached, I mean, they didn't need the internet. They could meet face-to-face with these young people, and that was part of the difficulty.
But that's not particular to Muslims. Britain has a very long liberal tradition of being prepared to accept people saying all sorts of very radical things, which are completely in opposition to the government. When this country was being formed as a country, some of the strongest and most outspoken support for the revolution was in Britain and in Ireland, and in my own city of Belfast, there was profoundly strong support for the radicals in this part of the world. And it has always been expected and accepted that that was appropriate and that that was part of the culture. So it's important to not think that Islam and Islamists were in any way special in that regard. It's simply been part of the culture.
But I think, Margaret, that does... That illustration, and we're grateful for the support to this day, Lord. But I think that illustration of a tradition helps to define what is a critical difference domestically in the United States today. It is in part the lack of an objective which the American people find sympathetic that defines American opposition and revulsion at terror tactics. I think that part of what Americans wonder, which the first question was, why do they hate us so much? Now it is, why are they attacking us? And it's now matured to the point of, what is the objective? What is it that they want that would lead them to fly an airplane into a tower full of civilians and kill people? And to pick up on something that Ed said, I think one of the things we have to realize when we assess our strategic vulnerability is the close political divisions of our population today are something that radicals of all sorts, including terrorists, see as having a great potential to exploit. Think how different this debate, this discussion, would be tomorrow if a 9/11 happened today in terms of our assessment of what is the would be required to be done in the United States.
Let me just go back, because I want to get finally to how we manage this. But Mark Sageman, if you could weigh back in here about, for instance, the... do you agree with Scott that the problem of prison radicalization is not a huge problem or potential problem here in the States. If you take the sort of template of the four elements of the paths to radicalization, where is the United States most vulnerable in terms of the indigenous population here, Muslim population?
Let's look at prisons first. You have 2 million people in prison in this country, and you have two guys who radicalized in Folsom Prison, and that's been blown up by Phil's colleague, Mr. Miller, another journalist. And it's laughable. One out of a million, that's a threat. Now, there are other form of radicalization in prison, but it's not the imam coming in. I mean, if you look, again, I'm a numbers guy. I'm just empirically driven. If you look at an imam who's in prison, who comes to prison for an hour and has to see 60 people, that's less than a minute. As a psychiatrist, I'm terribly envious of this guy because it takes me 10 years to have one patient after, you know, mourning and browbeating for 10 years to get them to change a little bit of harmful behavior. And this guy, in less than 60 seconds, can completely transform a person. That defies belief, as far as I'm concerned.
But how about the other model, the sort of young man just self-generating and egging one another on? And
well, that was my original point. That's exactly right. That's really, even in prison, that's exactly what happened. It was one guy who converted his prison inmate who didn't have a life term, kind of left after 10 years, and then kind of got two other guys, and they basically started robbing convenience store in Los Angeles. That is exactly what happened. Now, this, in a way, what's driving all of this is not really strategy. I mean, we tend to look at strategy and so on. This is a bottom-up phenomenon. Lord Alderdice is absolutely right, and Philip is absolutely right. This is about not only being cool, but this is about being a hero. This is about glory. And if the price of glory right now is death, so be it. But you want to be cool, you want to be the baddest guy around for your friends and to show them. And so, in a sense, what you can do may be strategic, but that's not really what drives us young people to do that. So the problem is that they're part of this whole movement, which indeed has a strategy, but they themselves are not thinking strategically. They just do this because they're going to be they have the front page on the newspaper, and you're going to have two experts on the Lehrer Hour debating this and giving it far more significance than actually it has.
So the question for the table, and I know Ed Meese wants to weigh in, so I'd like everyone to just, whoever wants to speak on this, is if that's the phenomenon, that is, that it is less of a directed strategy by a centrally organized operation, and instead there's a lot of self-generation, though inspiration, on the internet, and we probably haven't talked enough about the internet and the way that's exploited. What is the strategy for dealing with it?
Well, I just wanted to comment on the prison situation, because I don't think the prisons are very good recruiting grounds for terrorists. We have a little different culture, I think, among our prisoners, and it's very hard to mobilize them into altruistic self-sacrifice for somebody else's goal. They are more materialistic, I suspect. And their idea is to get out. If they're going to rob, they're going to rob for money or for drugs or something else. And so I think you have a very poor population to try to radicalize, no matter how many imams you put in there.
So Aminat, before we go to the other question, do you want to weigh in on the prison issue and whether you think prisons are a fertile breeding ground in this country?
I think they can be. But I would agree with Mies that at the moment, I don't think they are, but I think that they could be. The prisons are horrible. And the more we warehouse young men and women in the ways that we do, and we're unable to watch what kind of literature they're reading, who comes to talk with them. Chaplains are not necessarily trained chaplains. So that's one area of problem. We don't have a great deal of oversight and monitoring, even the male in the prison. But on the other side, I do agree that, and it was one article I'm reading and I'm not remembering it, but someone was advocating looking at criminality over terrorism, and that if you sentence people according to the criminality as opposed to the terrorism, then you would get sentences which made sense. And I think that that takes down the threat a little bit, or the potential. But I think if the prison system keeps going the way it is, then it's going to become some real fertile ground.
Pat Lang.
There always seems to be a kind of a assumption, you know, that, that they're like us in strange ways, you know, the people that we're concerned about here. And the fact of the matter is that in any situation that is tinged by the Islamic faith by as a kind of leaven in the bread, you know, of which there are many other ingredients as well, the idea that there has to be some sort of authorization from above or direction is just completely wrong. I mean, these are consensus-driven groups. And if you have a bunch of wacky kids, you know, are looking for to prove their manhood in the barrio or wherever it is that they're doing it, and they can do that around a kind of a half-baked idea of what Islam is, even though they don't really know much about the religion, and they all agree about it, well, the religion itself has within it the sanction for these guys saying that we're Muslims and this is Islam, you know. Now, the Sheikh of Al-Azhar might think they were absolutely squirrely, you know, but in fact, for them, their agreement amongst us, their consensus, constitutes what is the basic fighting marching unit of the Islamicate civilization, basically. And so I think we have to be careful, you know, that I don't think the United States is terribly vulnerable to this kind of thing, but the potential is always there for a group of people motivated in some way to come together and say, this is Islam, and Islam tells me to fight. And that can always happen. I think that we have to be a little cautious about. So
strategy for dealing with this, Lord Alderdice.
If you look at why young people buy jeans, the young person who buys the jeans has a different approach from the executive who's trying to get the jeans sold. And it's pretty silly, I think, to look at it as though it was all the same thing, even though the wish to have jeans may be semi-self-generated. So I don't think you're going to find anything about the group psychology of, and the politics of dealing with the wider issue by looking at individual young people, because they're not all the same, and there's a whole other set of issues there. I think there is a strategic question, not for the young people who were involved, but for the background to this whole movement, which is not specifically about Islam, but where Islam originated, which is in the Arab Middle Eastern community, which is deeply offended not just by the involvement of the West in the wider Middle East in the last 100 years, but also at our allies there who are their leaders, against whom they are extremely angry because of how they have used politics and their resources and have been supported by us. There is a strategic question for those people, and that is to get the West to withdraw strategically from the Middle East. That involves Israel, but it's not just a question of Israel. It's about resources and energy resources and so on and so on. For that reason, I think there is a strategic question for the US in terms of it making judgments about what it wants to do for the future, whether it's about energy policy or strategic policy of other kinds, and not just in relation to the Middle East, but in relation to other strategic powers who have their eyes on the Middle East. So there are questions of that kind that need to be addressed, and there is a very clear desire. If you listen to these people, you read what they say, they want for the Israel-Palestinian issue to be addressed. They want the wider Middle Eastern situation to be dealt with. They want a removal of those regimes that support the West and the removal of the West influence. And that's, if you, I think that there is actually the beginnings of a change of attitude in this country. In response to that, I think people are beginning to ask some questions about why we are in various places. And one of the great vulnerabilities this country has that, for example, the UK didn't have, is that young people in the UK 100 years ago were brought up in an educational and political and cultural system which said, we want you to go to India and spend the rest of your life there fighting for king and country. And, you know, don't bother coming back, but send us a letter every now and again. And a few hundred of them went and kept India under control for a few hundred years. There are not many young Americans who are brought up in a way that makes them want to go out to these regions and spend the rest of their lives there. And that's a very different context to try to run an arm's length power policy.
Who'd like to weigh in? Chris Dawson, we haven't heard from you for a while. What do you think should be our strategy for dealing with the phenomenon that we've been laying out here?
Well, I think there's furious agreement that these people are clearly vulnerable and marginalised and disenfranchised from mainstream society. But I guess it's the identification process for us all to understand what is it we don't know and how do we better understand that in order to arrive at a point where we can put some rapid but also sustainable policies in place. And you know, if it's not at the most strategic policy level, then we've got no chance of actually arriving at a point. And if those strategic policies will have to be multidisciplinary, multidimensional, and cover the full gamut of society, there just can't be a single solution in terms of a military solution. It's got to be much broader. That goes right into the very deep fabric of what is making these people feel so marginalised from society.
So on a micro level, though, what are you doing in your part of in Western Australia differently than you were 7 or 8 years ago in terms of knowing these communities, knowing the young people? To what degree are they being monitored? And I'm not making a judgment there that that's a good idea. I'm just asking as a factual matter, what's the sort of tactical approach you're taking?
Well, we were once, like many other countries, simply into dignitary protection and a tactical response, which is very much a reactive, responsive way. We are attempting very quickly to try and to get to a much more proactive understanding of how to prevent people either starting this journey and interrupting that journey before it gets going. And that means that we have to be involved in the education system, and we are. And that doesn't mean just in the schools. It means getting strong alliances and dialogue with the Muslim community or whatever part of the community, and beyond just the Muslim community, into the broader language that gets spoken by people in high office, people in the media, so that it's not seen as inflammatory, because some of it is about language. Some of it is about not causing friction and reaction in the community. But we are, for instance, educating our police officers. When you go to a particular house, you just can't treat everyone as you probably always once thought or the way you were brought up. And this is a need for greater understanding at all levels. So it's more than tactical. It's far more in a broader sense to make everyone understand that you just can't respond to an issue. There are deep-seated sociological issues here that we just don't really understand fully. We're trying to.
Ajit Doval, in India, is a different approach being taken than, say, 5-6 years ago?
Yes, in India there is a little different approach. Though at strategic level we fully understand that terrorism has to be fought and it has to be defeated. But at tactical level, I think our approach is slightly different than what has been the approach of the West. We would not like the terrorist group to have any hero.
To have any?
Any hero. Any icons. If you have made Osama bin Laden as man, Superman, or a human, mm-hmm. This thing was never been born of his leg. Every average, uninitiated Muslim boy, if you ask him, what would you like to become? 10-year-old. He's the biggest Muslim that he's ever heard of. Now, I think there are a lot of specialists sitting here. India has lost about 40,000 people in Islamic terrorism. Kashmir has been on this thing for about 18 years now. You can't name a single person who is leading that. Even in India, not many people know. We make a very deliberate effort to deny them the heroes. Here, a lot of effort is done. Even if an incident takes place, playing it up. I'm not telling that we should not respond very decisively. We should really hit as hard as we should at a place where it hurts them. But not where they feel the great media hype or a great statements by important people and others. That is what exactly the thing they were expecting to happen when they do that.
Mark,
Why do they do what they do? Mm-hmm. Is it that we fall into that trap? If we don't fall into that trap, we know maybe that there are 10% or 12% that they will be hunted within the country, across the country, around the world. We'll do what we want. Thirdly, I think, as far as tactical response is concerned, we would not allow them to unite the Muslims and make Islamic terrorism coterminous with Islam. And as far as possible, we have to make a lot of sacrifice on that. We know that that's not true. We know what's happening in madrasas. We know what's happening in the prisons. We know what's happening, what sort of contamination is going on. We would like to take specific, tactical, limited, calibrated action against the people and the individuals to achieve the best possible defined result, rather than have this thing. So they are at the tactical level. As far as strategic these things are concerned, I think we all agree that we will have to do something to see that if there are certain points of irritation, to the extent that they're reasonable and they can be addressed, they should be. But any wilting under the pressure, any succumbing to the pressure, will only whet their appetite and will become worse. So at strategic level, I don't think that we should be giving in. Like say, you know, we had a big problem with Sikh extremism, which is also a religious extremism. It withered away. We had a problem with a type of a Christian, this thing, in Mizoram. It withered away. Kashmir, it has come to about 20% of what it was. It's all on its way out. We know that in the next 5 years it will be out.
Let me interrupt just a second. Mark, you were nodding. Whenever, go right ahead.
I think that's right. You have to remove the glamour. Terrorism cannot be cool. If it continues to be cool, then you're going to have a continuing problem. So in a sense, you have to, first of all, demilitarize the issue. You got to remove the military. Because there's nothing more glamorous for a young kid than going against a uniform member of the only superpower left. That's really very simple, if you think about it. So you have to criminalize it, in a sense, almost go back to the 93 bombing, except that I don't think those guys carried the investigation far enough. You know, they just stopped, okay, we have a case, we can prosecute, it's done, goodbye. No, they should have gone a little bit further. Same thing for the 98 embassy bombing. They should have gone further. They still have Salim someplace. They want to prosecute him again. He was tied to the Hamburg group. And they actually was arrested in Germany. But, you know, they decided to bifurcate that case. They only kind of got four people, were minor people in this case. See, you have to have measured responses. You cannot overreact. If you overreact, you drive yourself straight into the hands of the terrorists. Because you are taking their frame, as we call it here, and you call it your discourse, and so you define the problem the same way they do, and Philip is right. They won, you know, in this case, because other young kids getting on the internet will get the same issue. So decriminalize it, remove the glamour of it, not overreact, measure, you know, law and order very much the way the British learn from their mistake, the original mistakes against the IRA, and finally they got it right, and I think we need to as well.
Let me get Philip Mudd here in on this. And, of course, we've had such conversation in this country about what the FBI is doing, what the U.S. government is doing to in this war on terror. And, George is handing me another note. So I don't want you to feel you have to repeat that, but perhaps you could say, what are you doing now that you weren't doing, say, in 2002, 2003, in terms of this tactical level, in terms of anticipating, knowing where the threat may be gathering within this community of mostly young, mostly men?
I think I could go through three or four things that I think are significant.
And can you pull your mic just
sure.
a little closer? Cause
let me start with the thing every resource manager would say was people in the movement of massive amounts of analyst agents to look at a problem helps. It's not a single-pronged solution, but the change in the application of resources from criminal to national security is substantial. It gives us the ability to look at cells and people in ways we could not have done before. So the first thing I'd say is resources. The second is when we look at a problem in California or Iowa or Florida or New York, the first question we have, and I see these problems briefed to the director every morning, is not whether we can prosecute the case. The first question we have is, do we have a sufficient understanding not only of what the threat is, that's to me a secondary issue, but of who the players are. Terrorism is not about events, it's about people. And the first question we have before we ever talk about what can we do about these folks is who's a player? And keep it running until we're learning nothing more. And the final thing, the real long pole in the tent, I think, is ensuring that we invest in people over time to train them, to give them opportunities to learn about this phenomenon, to require our field managers to talk to communities so that they learn about this phenomenon. But resources, the way we look at investigations and the way we're trying to understand this through a training process, I think are three pieces of what we have going. Final thing I'd say is on this debate about tactics and how we deal with this, there are two concerns I have long term. And the first is the persistence of the problem overseas means if we lose our focus, and that's diplomatic, military, financial aid, we're not over the hump overseas yet. We can't lose focus, and it takes a tremendous amount to keep our partners doing what we want them to do. And secondly and finally here, again, it relates to focus. It takes, if you take the British example, a year or less for someone between the time someone walks into a bookstore and the time they strap on a backpack. If we don't have the enforcement tools to look at people aggressively, that's too short a time to allow someone to radicalize themselves. We have to keep being able to look at these folks very early on, otherwise we lose this game.
And Scott.
Given that the overriding strategic issue for the world is how to successfully compete for rapidly dwindling fossil fuels, especially among the industrialized nations, that has to be dealt with on its own level, including things like alternative energy, which certainly shape the problem of terrorism as we live it. But one thing that is also a big problem and is sort of the complement to law enforcement is that the way the National Security Council is set up, the way its origins were set up in terms of statescraft, the way its policy planning boards are set up, it excludes labor, it excludes education, it excludes health, it excludes social services. It's all on intelligence, defense, kinetic reactions. And
it's all politico-military, in other words.
Yes. And there is no coherent policy in terms of health and human services that could provide an alternative for people in the world who are surfing on the internet and looking for some value framework. And let me just give you one example. In Azad Kashmir, right after the earthquake, despite what Musharraf said, anyone who was up there would see jihadis running around all over the place from Lashkar Tayyiba to Jaish-e Mohammed in military trucks with Kalashnikovs. And the only successful counterbalance to that was the Cubans, who sent in 3,000 doctors into every nook and cranny of Azad Kashmir. And to this day, if you go there and you ask the people who responded to the earthquake, to a person, they say they love the Cubans. And why? Because they send in doctors. Why can't the United States send in doctors? I mean, they make a lot of money here. They would have to make a true sacrifice, but why can't they do that?
We are going to go for a few questions. We have a little time, and George Gillum has a microphone. And are you going to walk to the person who wants to?
Let them come to us.
Okay, so if people who'd like to ask a question could go to the back of the room and the microphone that George Gillum has. And I will ask, since we don't, what do we have, maybe 10, 15 minutes?
10 to 15 minutes.
So please, if you would, be very brief and make sure they are a question. It is a question.
When I was at the University of North Carolina, I had to make a decision between precept and example. And no one here has mentioned the United States as an example. I was in the Marine Corps, and I was very pleased that we had the atomic bomb. Yet that is a different kind of an example. And we chose Hiroshima and Nagasaki, where we killed hundreds of thousands of people with one blow. That's quite an example of the weapons of mass destruction. Number two.
I'm sorry, sir.
We need to make it a question.
If you could give us your question.
Why hasn't that been mentioned as a tactic that we used in a particular situation? One, it saved my life, maybe, from going to Japan. At the same time, it was a lesson to the jihadists.
Pat Lang.
Well, I have to agree with Mr. Atran over here, you know, that you have to make up your mind as just how big a threat these people really are. I mean, in fact, when the word strategic used to be used in the Cold War context as talking about the death of 40 million people, you know, the kind of weapons you use then. I remember that was the number that would result from a first strike here. And you know, these kind of losses we're talking about now are it would be very painful to be on a bus when the bus blew up. I mean, there's no doubt about that. You'd certainly be a memorable event. But in fact, it isn't a strategic threat in the sense that people seem to think it is. And so that being the case, you have to ask yourself, you know, at what cost do you wish to strike people? You know, how much do you really want to damage them? How much do you want to damage societies? Occasionally I hear people say, well, let's bomb such and such a place. You know, well, there's no way at all of knowing who you're really killing in a situation like that. So if you're not going to be discriminating about the people who are involved in a fairly small-scale threat against you, then, in fact, you're setting out to make everything vastly worse. And Lord Alderdice here thinks, evidently, that American policy causes jihadism. Western policy, excuse me. And you know, I think that that's a doubtful business in itself. And there are plenty of psychological and social factors embedded in the culture of the world right now that the way Mark talks about that causes kids to want to join things like this. So you don't have to start talking about how you're going to destroy cities and civilizations and things like that. I think it was inappropriate and out of scale.
I think you have a very different thing in a wartime situation where you're dealing with states, because the use of an atom bomb or something like that is to cause the leaders of those states to give up or to not prosecute the war any further. I think when you have non-state agents that we're dealing with here, and particularly when you have religiously motivated people, you have a very different situation than you would have, say, in the Hiroshima situation.
Margaret, I think the gentleman asks a very important question when we talk about how does our own behavior, what we do, affect how people see us. But I think we also need to look at the things we do well, and not to belabor the point unnecessarily, but we would do well to look at the examples we give to the world of the things we do well, such as supplying a people an unprecedented degree of individual liberty, unprecedented in all of human history, providing religious freedom to people, and so forth. I don't think we do a good enough job, frankly, when we go out in the world of explaining why we are the way we are. And it's not that we do everything right, of course. I suppose we could have a debate about the maintenance of nuclear weapons and so forth. But we do many things very well and very right by people, just on a humanistic scale.
Sir.
I'm UJ Fields, and I'm just reissuing a report that I made in 1992 of the Rodney King riot in Los Angeles 15 years ago. And of course, in that incident, 53 people were killed. I happened to also be in Los Angeles during the Watts riot when 34 people were killed. I was also in Montgomery during the Montgomery bus boycott when the Selma situation exploded in Montgomery. Of course, my question is, and someone mentioned the prisons, where there's more than 2.3 million people in prison. Now, it seems to me that we have had terrorism all the time.
We need to phrase this as a question.
Yeah. I'm trying to see, now we have what you would call equal opportunity terrorism. And I want to see whether or not you see that terrorism in the past really is less dangerous when you look at the lives killed now than it were in times past.
I'd like to take that.
Of course, terrorism is not particularly unique to this century and to the immediate past century. Most of the tactics that we're looking at now were developed by the anarchists in the 19th century. And actually, what brought that to an end was the First World War, and the Second World War was in many ways simply the lack of completion of the first one. And I think the thing that we need to be very thoughtful and careful about is that when these episodes of terrorism begin, they begin because of hearts and minds issues. And they are not resolved until those issues are resolved. For Britain, don't forget, when the terrorism started in Ireland, within a short number of years, it led to the unzipping of the whole of the British Empire. And I don't think you should underestimate the impact of some of these things, because American power is not all about America control of this landmass. It's also to do with the projection of influence. And I think that that's something you need to take into account when you're thinking. It's not simply a question of whether you get bombs exploding or planes exploding on the mainland here that determines whether or not American national interests are affected and addressed.
Mark wanted to weigh in also.
John Rod Alderdice. But why is the issue now probably becoming more important? I think it is. Modern terrorism is really a function of dynamite. Once dynamite was invented in the 1860s, a group of small people could terrorize a large group of people. That's really the start. And then there's several waves. The first one, John is right, it was the anarchist, and then you have the anti-colonialist, and you have the leftist. Now we have religious wave. We're probably going to have an environmentalist wave. But the reason it's very important now is that as technology has evolved, we still are under the dynamite era. People are still using explosive, but now we have the potential of having weapons of mass destruction. And now you're really talking about super terrorism. And we haven't really seen it yet. Yeah, you have Aum Shinrikyo that really kind of attempted, but, you know, I mean, there's only 12 people who died. They were pretty incompetent. But the danger is there. And you cannot, Philip is right, you cannot wait for it to develop so it becomes a 50-50 proposition at the end so that people will use those weapons. I mean, we're talking now about strategic thing. You know, the swine flu epidemic of 1918 wiped out 40 to 60 to 80 million. I mean, they don't really know. That's a large number of people. There's a potential of doing something like that right now. So, again, let's not be complacent. There is a danger. We have to do things now before it's too late, that people may have more access to those weapons of mass destruction and do things that way. But 9/11 was not a weapons of mass destruction terrorism. I mean, it had a large number, but it was still fairly conventional if you think about it. And I just hope that Philip will be at his job forever so he can protect me. Thank you.
I'm sorry, Philip was just going to add one. Go ahead.
Happen for the record.
Oh. Wait, you're not going to be around forever to protect him? Oh. Last question, yes, sir.
Last question is from Mr. Fred Scott.
If Islam is a religion of peace, and I'm willing to accept that it is, where are the imams saying this is unacceptable? Where, and if they're not saying it, Why aren't they?
Exaggeration to say that Islam is a religion of peace. I mean, this is silly. You know, this is really quite patronizing toward the Muslims, in fact. I know a lot of Muslims, and in fact, they will tell you in a heartbeat that they are peaceful as it is appropriate to be peaceful, you know. And that is their overall attitude toward things. They are enjoined by their religious law to be kindly to people who do not threaten them and who accept the fact that Islam and the Islamic civilization are the paramount things on earth. That's right. And as long as people don't mess with them too much, they're inclined to be fairly quietistic. But that doesn't mean, as I said before, and I'm going to hit it again here, in fact, that any group of people who claim to be Muslim and who agree with each other that violent jihad is justified in any given situation, for them, that is Islam. This is a religion of laymen. There are no priests. There is no hierarchy. There is none of that stuff. So in religious law is derived from consensus among the believers. So in fact, if you get a group of people who agree that you, for some reason, are an enemy of Islam and of God, then in fact violence toward you is justified. And see,
I'm gonna. Oh, I'm sorry, but I'm. Mrs. No, McLeod
just,
first.
Just speaking as an insider in the community, I think the first part of what he said was absolutely true. I totally disagree that we would. That Muslims in any way, shape, or form sit around and try to get a consensus on who's a bad person. But I do think that one of the... Okay, if you didn't, I'm sorry. The other part of that is many in the Muslim community have spoken about the situation going on. I think one part of that has been that the people who were asked were immigrants. And I don't think they had a real clear understanding of what Americans mean when they want to hear that you're as upset as they are. So I think there was a little cultural ships passing in the night. And since then, there was a little window open. And after, I want to say maybe 6 months or so, that window began to shut very, very quickly. There are no Muslim news anchors. Muslims were no longer invited to be on programs for a variety of reasons, some of which I think were very, very legitimate. But that's why you haven't heard them. And after a while, many of those imams who were never spokespeople in the same way that he's talking about for the community felt that there was no sense in speaking. What else can I say? If I say I'm as scared as you are, if I say I am totally against this kind of terror tactic, and you say that is not enough, then what else can I do? So I think they're very much in a catch-22. I think had indigenous Muslims been asked right after 9/11, the attitude and the response would have been very different because the language is very different.
I think that is going to be the last word. And I thank you all very much, and have a wonderful coming conference.